Chapter 9. The Inquisitor relaxed her seat restraints and sketched a window for herself in the opaque hull material of the Triumvir's shuttle. The hull obligingly opened a transparent rectangle, offering the Inquisitor her first view of Resurgam from space in 15 years. Much had changed, even in that relatively brief span of planetary time. Clouds which had previously been vapid streaks of high-altitude moisture now billowed in thick, creamy masses, whipped into spiral patterns by the blind artistry of Coriolis force. Sunlight glared back at her from the enameled surfaces of lakes and miniature seas. There were hard-edged expanses of green and gold stitched across the planet in geometric clusters, threaded by silver-blue irrigation channels deep enough to carry barges. There were the faint gray scratches of slev lines and highways. Cities and settlements were smears of cross-hatched streets and buildings, barely resolved even when the Inquisitor asked the window to flex into magnification mode. Near the hubs of the oldest settlements, like Cuvier, were the remnants of the old habitat domes or their foundation rings. Now and then she saw the bright moving bead of a transport dirigible high in the stratosphere, or the much smaller speck of an aircraft on government duty. But on this scale, most human activity was invisible. She might as well have been studying surface features on some hugely magnified virus. The Inquisitor, who after years of suppressing that part of her personality, was again beginning to think of herself as Ana Kuri, did not have any particularly strong feelings of attachment to Resurgam, even after all the years she had spent incognito on its surface. But what she saw from orbit was sobering. The planet was more than the temporary colony it had been when she had first arrived in the system. It was a home to many people, all they had known. In the course of her investigations, she had met many of them, and she knew that there were still good people on Resurgam. They could not all be blamed for the present government or the injustices of the past. They at least deserved the chance to live and die on the world they had come to call their home. And by dying, she meant by natural causes. That, unfortunately, was the part that could no longer be guaranteed. The shuttle was tiny and fast. The Triumvir, Ilya Volyova, was snoozing in the other seat, with the peak of a nondescript grey cap tugged down over her brow. It was the shuttle that had brought her down to Resurgam in the first place, before she contacted the Inquisitor. The shuttle's avionics program knew how to dodge between the government radar sweeps, but it had always seemed prudent to keep such excursions to a minimum. If they were caught, if there was even a suspicion that a spacecraft was routinely entering and leaving Resurgam's atmosphere, heads would roll at every level of government. Even if Inquisition House was not directly implicated, Curry's position would become extremely unsafe. The backgrounds of key government personnel would be subjected to a deep and probing scrutiny. Despite her precautions, her origins might be revealed. The stealthy ascent had necessitated a shallow acceleration profile, but once it was clear of atmosphere and outside the effective range of the radar sweeps, the shuttle's engines revved up to 3 Gs, pressing the two of them back into their seats. Curry began to feel drowsy and realized, just as she slid into sleep, that the shuttle was pumping a perfumed narcotic into the air. She slept dreamlessly and awoke with the same mild sense of objection. They were somewhere else. "How long were we under?" she asked Volyova, who was smoking.
"Just under a day. I hope that alibi you cooked up was good, Anna. You're going to need it when you get back to Cuvier."
"I said I had to go into the wilderness to interview a deep cover agent. Don't worry. I established the background for this a long time ago. I always knew I might have to be away for a while."
Curry undid her seat restraints. The shuttle was no longer accelerating, and attempted to scratch an itch somewhere near the small of her back.
"Any chance of a shower, whenever we get where we're going?"
"That depends. Where exactly do you think we're headed?
Let's just say I have a horrible feeling I've already been there."
Volyova stubbed out her cigarette and made the front of the hull turn glassy. They were in deep interplanetary space, still in the ecliptic, but good light minutes from any world. Yet something was blocking the view of the starfield ahead of them.
"There she is, Anna. The good ship Nostalgia for Infinity. Still very much as you left her. Thanks."
Any other cheering sentiments while you're at it?
The last time I checked, the showers were out of order.
The last time you checked?
Volyova paused and made a clacking sound with her tongue.
Buckle up. I'm taking us in.
They swooped in close to the dark, misshapen mass of the light-hugger. Kuri remembered her first approach to this same ship, back when she had been tricked aboard it in the Epsilon Eridani system. It had looked just about normal then, about what one would expect of a large, moderately old trade light-hugger. There had been a distinct absence of odd excrescences and protuberances, a marked lack of dagger-like jutting appendages or elbowed turret-like growths. The hull had been more or less smooth, worn and weathered here and there, interrupted by machines, sensor pods and entry bays in other places, but there had been nothing about it that would have invited particular comment or disquiet. There had been no acres of lizard-skin texturing or dried mudplain expanses of interlocked platelets, no suggestion that buried biological imperatives had finally erupted to the surface in an orgy of biomechanical transformation. But now the ship did not look much like a ship at all. What it did resemble, if Kuri had to associate it with anything, was a fairy-tale palace gone sick, a once-glittering assemblage of towers and oubliettes and spires that had been perverted by the vilest of magics. The basic shape of the starship was still evident. She could pick out the main hull and its two jutting engine nacelles, each larger than a freight dirigible hangar. But that functional core was almost lost under the baroque growth layers that had lately stormed the ship. Various organizing principles had been at work, ensuring that the growths, which had been mediated by the ship's repair and redesign subsystems, had a mad artistry about them, a foul flamboyance which both awed and revolted. There were spirals like the growth patterns in ammonites. There were whorls and knots like vastly magnified wood grain. There were spars and filaments and net-like meshes, bristling hair-like spines and blocky, cankerous masses of interlocked crystals. There were places where some major structure had been echoed and re-echoed in a fractal diminuendo, vanishing down to the limit of vision. The crawling intricacies of the transformations operated on all scales. If one looked for too long, one started seeing faces or parts of faces in the juxtapositions of warped armor. Look longer and one started seeing one's own horrified reflection. But under all that, Kuri thought, it was still a ship.
Well, she said, I see it hasn't got a fuck of a lot better since I was away.
Volyova smiled beneath the brim of her cap. I'm encouraged. That sounds a lot less like the Inquisitor and a lot more like the old Anakuri.
Yeah? Pity it took a fucking nightmare like that to bring me back.
Oh, this is nothing. Volyova said cheerfully.
Wait until we're inside.
The shuttle had to swerve through a wrinkled eye-like gap in the hull growth to reach the docking bay. But the interior of the bay was still more or less rectangular, and the major servicing systems, which had never much depended on nanotechnology, were still in place and recognizable. An assortment of other in-system craft was packed into the chamber, ranging from blunt-nosed vacuum tugs to major shuttles. They docked. This part of the ship was not spun for gravity, so they disembarked under weightless conditions, pulling themselves along via grab rails. Kuri was more than willing to let Volyova go ahead of her. Both of them carried torches and emergency oxygen masks, and Kuri was very tempted to start using her supply. The air in the ship was horribly warm and humid, with a rotten taste to it. It was like breathing someone else's stomach gas. Kuri covered her mouth with her sleeve, fighting the urge to retch.
Ilya, you'll get used to it. It isn't harmful.
She extracted something from her pocket.
Cigarette? Have you ever known me to say yes to one of those damn things before?
There's always a first time.
Kuri waited while Volyova lit the cigarette for her and then drew on it experimentally. It was bad, but still a marked improvement on unfiltered ship air.
Filthy habits, really, Volyova said with a smile. But then filthy times call for filthy habits. Feeling better now?
Kuri nodded, but without any great conviction. They moved through gullet-like tunnels whose walls glistened with damp secretions or beguilingly regular crystal patterns.
Kuri brushed herself along with gloved hands. Now and then she recognized some old aspect of the ship, a conduit, bulkhead, or inspection box, but typically it would be half-melted into its surroundings or surreally distorted. Hard surfaces had become fuzzily fractal, extending blurred grey boundaries into thin air. Vari-coloured slimes and unguents threw back their torchlights in queasy diffraction patterns. Amoeba-like blobs drifted through the air, following, or at times swimming against it seemed, the prevailing shipboard air currents. Via grinding locks and wheels, they transferred to the part of the ship that was still rotating. Kuri was grateful for the gravity, but with it came an unanticipated unpleasantness. Now there was somewhere for the fluids and secretions to run to. They dripped and dribbled from the walls in miniature cataracts, congealing on the floor before finding their way to a drainage aperture or hole. Certain secretions had formed stalagmites and stalactites, amber and snot-green prongs fingering between floor and ceiling. Kuri did her best not to brush against them, but it was not the easiest of tasks. She noticed that Volyova had no such inhibitions. Within minutes her jacket was smeared and swabbed with several varieties of shipboard effluent. "Relax," Volyova said, noticing her discomfort. "It's perfectly safe. There's nothing on the ship that can harm either of us. You, have had those gunnery implants taken out, haven't you? You should remember. You did it. Just checking. Huh. You're actually enjoying this, aren't you? I've learned to take my pleasures where I can find them, Anna. Especially in times of deep existential crisis." Ilya Volyova flicked a cigarette butt into the shadows and lit herself another. They continued in silence. Eventually they reached one of the elevator shafts that threaded the ship lengthwise, like the main elevator shaft in a skyscraper. With the ship rotating rather than being under thrust, it was much easier to move along its lateral axis. But it was still 4 kilometers from the tip of the ship to its tail, so it made sense to use the shafts wherever possible. To Kuri's surprise, a car was waiting for them in the shaft. She followed Volyova into it with moderate trepidation, but the car looked normal inside and accelerated smoothly enough. "The elevators are still working?" Kuri asked. "They're a key shipboard system," Volyova said. "Remember, I've got tools for containing the plague. They don't work perfectly, but I can at least steer the disease clear of anything I don't want to become too corrupted. And the captain himself is occasionally willing to assist. The transformations aren't totally out of his control, it seems." Volyova had finally raised the matter of the captain. Until that moment, Kuri had been clinging to the hope that it might all turn out to be a bad dream she had confused with reality. But there it was. The captain was very much alive. "What about the engines? Still functionally intact as far as I can tell, but only the captain has control of them. Have you been talking with him?" "I'm not sure talking is quite the word I'd use. Communicating, possibly. But even that might be stretching things." The elevator veered, switching between shafts. The shaft tubes were mostly transparent, but the elevator spent much of its time whisking between densely packed decks or boring through furlongs of solid hull material. Now and then, through the window, Kuri saw dank chambers zoom by. Mostly they were too large for her to see the other side in the weakly reflected light of the elevator. There were 5 chambers which were the largest of all, huge enough to hold cathedrals. She thought of the one Volyova had shown her during her first tour of Infinity, the one that held the 40 horrors. There were fewer than 40 of them now, but that was surely still enough to make a difference, even perhaps against an enemy like the inhibitors, provided that the captain could be persuaded. "Have you and him patched up your differences?" Kuri asked. "I think the fact that he didn't kill us when he had the chance more or less answers that question. And he doesn't blame you for what you did to him?" For the first time there was a sign of annoyance from Volyova. "Did to him? Anna, what I did to him was an act of extreme mercy. I didn't punish him at all. I merely stated the facts and then administered the cure. which by some definitions was worse than the disease. Now Valyova shrugged. He was going to die. I gave him a new lease on life. Kuri gasped as another chamber ghosted by, filled with fused metamorphic shapes. If you call this living, word of advice. Valyova leant closer, lowering her voice. There's a very good chance he can hear this conversation. Just keep that in mind, will you? There's a good girl. If anyone else had spoken to her like that, they would have been nursing at least one interesting dislocation about 2 seconds later. But Kuri had long since learned to make allowances for Valyova. Where is he? Still on the same level as before. Depends what you mean by him. I suppose you could say his epicenter is still there, yes. But there's really very little point in distinguishing between him and the ship nowadays. Then he's everywhere. All around us. All-seeing. All-knowing. I don't like this, Ilya. If it's any consolation, I very much doubt that he does either. After many delays, reversals and diversions, the elevator finally brought them to the bridge of Nostalgia for Infinity. To Kuri's considerable relief, a consultation with the captain did not seem to be imminent. The bridge was much as she remembered it. The chamber was damaged and careworn, but most of the vandalism had been inflicted before the captain changed. Kuri had even done some of it herself. Seeing the impact craters where her weapons discharges had fallen gave her a faint and mischievous sense of pride. She remembered the tense power struggle that had taken place aboard the Lighthugger when it was in orbit around the neutron star Hades, on the very edge of the present system. It had been touch and go at times, but because they had survived, she had dared to believe that a greater victory had been won. But the arrival of the inhibitor machine suggested otherwise. The battle, in all likelihood, had already been lost before the first shots were fired. But they had at least bought themselves a little time. Now they had to do something with it. Kuri settled into one of the seats, facing the bridge's projection sphere. It had been repaired since the mutiny, and now showed a real-time display of the Resurgam system. There were 11 major planets, but the display also showed their moons and the larger asteroids and comets. All were of potential importance. Their precise orbital positions were indicated, along with vectors showing the motion, prograde or retrograde, of the body in question. Pale cones radiating from the Lighthugger showed the extent of the ship's instantaneous deep sensor coverage, corrected for light travel time. Valyova had strewn a handful of monitor drones on other orbits so that they could peer into blind spots and increase the interferometric baseline, but she used them cautiously. "Ready for a recent history lesson?" Valyova asked. "You know I am, Ilya. I just hope this little jaunt turns out to be worth it, because I'm still going to have to answer some tricky questions when I get back to Cuvier. They may not seem so massively pressing when you've seen what I have to show you." She made the display zoom in, enlarging one of the moons spinning around the system's second-largest gas giant. "This is where the inhibitors have set up camp?" Kuri asked. "Here and on two other worlds of comparable size. Their activities on each seem broadly the same." Now dark shapes fluttered into view around the moon. They swarmed and scattered like agitated crows, their numbers and shapes in constant flux. In an instant, they settled onto the surface of the moon, linking together in purposeful formations. The playback was evidently accelerated, hours compressed into seconds, perhaps, for transformations blistered across the moon's surface in a quick black inundation. Zoom-in showed a tendency for the structures to be formed of cubic sub-elements of widely differing sizes. Vast lasers pumped heat back into space as the transformations raged. Grotesque black machines the size of mountains clotted the landscape, ramping down the moon's albedo until only infrared could tease out significant patterns. "What are they doing?" Kuri asked. "I couldn't tell at first." 1 or 2 weeks had passed before what was taking place became clear. Dotted at regular intervals around the moon's equator were volcanic apertures, squat, gape-mouthed machines that extended 1/100th of the moon's diameter into space. Without warning, they began to spew out rocky material in ballistic dust plumes. The matter was hot, but not actually molten. It arced above the moon, falling into orbit. Another machine, Volyova had not noticed it until then, circled in the same orbit, processing the dust, shepherding, cooling, and compactifying the plume. In its wake, it left an organized ring system of processed and refined matter, gigatons of it, in tidy lanes. Droves of smaller machines trailed behind like minnows, sucking in the pre-refined matter and subjecting it to even further purification.
"What's happening?" "The machines seem to be dismantling the moon," Volyova said.
"That much I figured out for myself, but it strikes me as a pretty cumbersome way of going about it. We've got crust-buster warheads that would do the same thing in a flash.
And in the process, vaporize and disperse half of the moon's matter."
Volyova nodded sagely.
"I don't think that's quite what they wanted to do. I think they want all that matter processed and refined as efficiently as possible. More, in fact, since they're ripping apart three moons. There's a lot of volatile material they won't be able to process into solids, not unless they're going to be doing some heavy-duty alchemy. But my guess is they'll still give themselves around 100 billion tons of raw material.
That's a lot of rubble."
"Yes, and it rather begs the question, what precisely do they need it for?"
"I suppose you've got a theory?" Ilya Volyova smiled.
"Not much more than guesswork at this stage. The lunar dismantling's still in progress, but I think it's reasonably clear that they want to build something. And do you know what? I strongly suspect that whatever it is may not have our absolute best interests at heart."
"You think it's going to be a weapon, don't you?"
"Obviously, I'm getting predictable in my old age, but yes, I rather fear a weapon is on the cards. What kind? I can't begin to guess. Clearly, they could have already destroyed the Resurgium if that was their immediate intention, and they wouldn't need to dismantle it neatly.
Then they've got something else in mind."
"It would seem so."
"We've got to do something about it, Ilya. We've still got the cash. We could make some kind of difference even now."
Volyova turned off the display sphere. "At the moment, they seem not to be aware of our presence. We appear to fall beneath their detection threshold unless we're in the vicinity of Hades. Would you be willing to compromise that by using the cash weapons?"
"If I felt it was our last best hope, I might."
"So would you. I'm just saying there won't be any going back. We have to be completely clear about that."
Volyova was silent for a moment.
"There's something else as well."
"Yes?"
She lowered her voice. "We can't control the cash, not without his help. The captain will need to be persuaded."
Of course, they did not call themselves the inhibitors. They had never seen any reason to name themselves anything. They simply existed to perform a duty of astonishing importance, a duty vital to the future existence of intelligent life itself. They did not expect to be understood or sympathized with. So any name, or any hint of justification, was entirely superfluous. Yet they were passingly aware that this was a name that had been given, assigned to them after the glorious extinctions that had followed the Dawn War. Through a long, tenuous chain of recollection, the name had been passed from species to species, even as those species were wiped from the face of the galaxy. The inhibitors. Those that inhibit. Those that suppress the emergence of intelligence. The Overseer recognized, ruefully, that the name was indeed an accurate description of its work. It was difficult to say exactly where and when the work had begun. The Dawn War had been the first significant event in the history of the inhabited galaxy, a clashing of a million newly emergent cultures. These were the first starfaring species to arise, the players at the beginning of the game. The Dawn War, ultimately, had been about a single precious resource. It had been about metal. She returned to Resurgium. In Inquisition House, there were questions to be answered.
She fielded them with as much insouciance as she could muster. She had been in the wilderness, she said, handling a highly sensitive field report from an agent who had stumbled on an exceptionally good lead. The trail to the Triumvir, she told her doubters, was hotter than it had been in years. To prove this, she reactivated certain closed files and had old suspects invited back to Inquisition House for follow-up interviews. Inwardly, she felt sick at what had to be done to maintain the illusion of probity. Innocents had to be detained and made, for the sake of realism, to feel as if their lives, or at least their liberties, were in extreme jeopardy. It was a detestable business. Once she had sweetened it by making sure that she only terrorized people who were known to have evaded punishment for other crimes, revealed by judicious snooping of the files of rival government departments. It had worked for a time, but then even that had begun to seem morally questionable. But now it was worse. She had doubters in the administration, and to silence their qualms, she had to make her investigations unusually efficient and ruthless. There had to be plausible rumors circulating Cuvier of the degrees to which Inquisition House was prepared to go. People had to suffer for the sake of her cover. She reassured herself that it was all ultimately in their best interests, that what she was doing was for the greater good of Resurgam, that a few terrified souls here and there were a small price to pay when set against the protection of an entire world. She stood at the window of her office in Inquisition House, looking down towards the street, watching another guest being bundled into a blunt grey electric car. The man stumbled as the guards walked him to it. His head was covered and his hands were tied behind his back. The car would speed through the city until it reached a residential zone. It would be dusk by then, and the man would be dumped into the gutter a few blocks from his home. His bonds would have been loosened, but the man would likely lie still on the ground for several minutes, breathing hard, gasping at the realization that he had been released. Perhaps a gang of friends would find him as they made their way to a bar or back from the repair factories. They would not recognize him at first, for the beating he had taken would have swollen his face and made it difficult for him to talk. But when they did, they would help the man back to his house, glancing warily over their shoulders in case the government agents who had dumped him were still abroad. Or perhaps the man would find his own feet and, peering through the slits of the bloodied, bruised eyelids, might somehow contrive to find his own way home. His wife would be waiting, perhaps more scared now than anyone in Cuvier. When her husband came home, she would experience something of the same mingled relief and terror that he had experienced upon regaining consciousness. They would hold each other despite the pain that the man was in. Then she would examine his wounds and clean what could be cleaned. There would be no broken bones, but it would take a proper medical examination to be sure of that. The man would assume that he had been lucky, that the agents who had beaten him had been weary after a hard day in the interrogation cells. Later, perhaps, he would hobble to the bar to meet his friends. Drinks would be bought, and in some quiet corner he would show them the worst of the bruises, and word would spread that he had acquired them in Inquisition House. His friends would ask him how he could ever have fallen under suspicion of being involved with the Triumvir, and he would laugh and say that there was no stopping Inquisition House, not now. That anyone even remotely suspected of impeding the house's inquiries was fair game, that the pursuit of the criminal had been notched up to such an intensity that any misdemeanor against any government branch could be assumed to indicate tacit support for the Triumvir. Curry watched the car glide away and pick up speed. Now she could barely remember what the man had looked like. They all began to look the same after a while, the men and women blurring into one homogeneous, terrified whole. Tomorrow there would be more. She looked above the buildings into the bruise-colored sky. She imagined the processes that she now knew were taking place beyond Resurgam's atmosphere. No more than one or two light hours away, vast and implacable alien machinery was engaged in reducing three worlds to fine metallic dust. The machines seemed unhurried, unconcerned with doing things on a recognizably human timescale. They went about their business with the quiet calm of undertakers. Curry recalled what she had already learned of the inhibitors, information vouchsafed to her after she had infiltrated Volyova's crew. There had been a war at the dawn of time, a war that had encompassed the entire galaxy and numerous cultures. In the desolate aftermath of that war, one species, or collective of species, had determined that intelligent life could no longer be tolerated. They had unleashed dark droves of machines, whose only function was to watch and wait, vigilant for the signs of emergent starfaring cultures. They left traps dotted through space, glittery baubles designed to attract the unwise. The traps both alerted the inhibitors to the presence of a new outbreak of intelligence and also served as psychological probing mechanisms, constructing a profile of the soon-to-be-culled fledglings. The traps gauged the technological prowess of an emergent culture and suggested the manner in which they might attempt to counter the inhibitor threat. For some reason that Kuri did not understand, and which had certainly never been explained to her, the response to the emergence of intelligence had to be proportionate. It was not enough simply to wipe out all life in the galaxy, or even in a pocket of the galaxy. There was, she sensed, a deeper purpose to the inhibitor culls that she did not yet grasp, and might not ever be capable of grasping. And yet the machines were imperfect. They had begun to fail. It was nothing that could be detected over any timescale shorter than a few million years. Most species did not endure that long, so they saw only grim continuity. The only way that the decline could be observed was in the much longer term, evidenced not in the records of individual cultures, but in the subtle differences between them. The ruthlessness quotient of the inhibitors remained as high as ever, but their methods were becoming less efficient, their response times slower. Some profound and subtle flaw in the machine's design had worked its way to the surface. Now and then, a culture slipped through the net, managing to spread into interstellar space before the inhibitors could contain and cull it. The cull then became more difficult, less like surgery and more like butchery. The Amarantin, the bird-like creatures who had lived on Resurgim a million years earlier, had been one such species. The effort to cleanse them had been protracted, allowing many of them to slip into various hidden sanctuaries. The last act of the culling machines had been to annihilate Resurgim's biosphere by triggering a catastrophic stellar flare. Delta Pavonis had since settled down to normal sun-like activity, but it was only now that Resurgim was beginning to support life again. Their work done, the inhibitors had vanished back into the stellar cold. 990,000 years passed. Then humans came, drawn to the enigma of the vanished Amarantin culture. Their leader had been Sylvest, the ambitious scion of a wealthy Yellowstone family. By the time Kuri, Volyova, and Nostalgia for Infinity arrived in the system, Sylvest had put in place his plans for exploring the neutron star on the system's edge, convinced that Hades had something to do with the Amarantin extinction. Sylvest had coerced the crew of the starship into helping him, using its cache of weapons to break through shells of defensive machinery and finally penetrating to the heart of a moon-sized artifact. They called it Cerberus, which orbited the neutron star. Sylvest had been right all along about the Amarantin, but in verifying his theory, he had also sprung a primed inhibitor trap. At the heart of the Cerberus object, Sylvest had died in a massive matter-antimatter explosion. And at the same time, he had not died at all. Kuri knew. She had met and spoken to Sylvest after his death. So far as she was capable of understanding it, Sylvest and his wife had been stored as simulations in the crust of the neutron star itself. Hades, it turned out, was one of the sanctuaries that the Amarantin had used when they were being harried by the inhibitors. It was an element of something much older than either the Amarantin or the inhibitors, a transcendent information storage and processing system, a vast archive. The Amarantin had found a way inside it, and so, much later, had Sylvest. That was as much as Kuri knew, and as much as she wanted to know. She had met the stored Sylvest only once. In the more than 60 years that had passed since then, the time that Volyova had spent carefully infiltrating the very society that feared and loathed her, Kuri had allowed herself to forget that Sylvest was still out there, was still in some sense alive in the Hades computational matrix. On those rare occasions when she did think about him, she found herself wondering if he ever gave a moment's thought to the consequences of his actions all those years ago, if memories of the inhibitors ever stirred him from vain dreams of his own brilliance. She doubted it, for Sylvester had not struck her as someone overly troubled by the results of his own deeds. And in any case, by Sylvester's accelerated reckoning, for time passed very rapidly in the Hades matrix, the events must have been centuries of subjective time in his past, as inconsequential as childhood misdeeds. Very little could touch him in there, so what was the point of worrying about him? But that hardly helped those who were still outside the Matrix. Kurian Volyova had spent only 20 of those 60-plus years out of reefer sleep, for their infiltration scheme had been necessarily slow and episodic. But of those 20 years, Kuri doubted that a single day had passed when she had not thought of, and worried about, the prospect of the inhibitors. Now, at least, her worry had transmuted into certainty. They were here. The thing that she had dreaded had finally started. And yet, it was not to be a quick, brutal culling. Something titanic was being brought into existence. Something that required the raw material of 3 entire worlds. For the time being, the activities of the inhibitors could not be detected from Resurgam, even with the tracking systems put in place to spot approaching lighthuggers. But Kuri doubted that this could continue to be the case. Sooner or later, the activities of the alien machines would exceed some threshold, and the citizenry would begin to glimpse strange apparitions in the sky. Very likely, all hell would break loose. But by then, it might not even matter.